I'm going to go straight into it in the interest of time. And I'm going to be quite blunt in my remarks and say some things that I think might surprise you. I advise a lot of the biggest investors in the world. I'm advising governments. I'm currently working with the British government on Brexit. We'll talk about that. But I'm also a manufacturer. I decided a few years ago, instead of just talking about the world economy, I would try to be part of actually building it and part of the innovation space. Best decision I ever made. But when Graham came to me with this topic of beliefs, biases, and behaviors, I have to say I was delighted because I have such strong views about how these hold investors back and unnecessarily. So let me start with the key points. Number one, everywhere I go, especially in Australia, but frankly globally, China is the future, the US is up the creek. The problem I have with this is the Chinese are so clear that they're unable to generate the GDP they need to keep that society stable. They know that their costs have gone out of control. Their wages are up, the cost of production. And this is why Foxconn is now manufacturing phones in the United States. By the way, the reference to the guy in the audience who was from the middle of the country, I'd say everybody should go talk to him, whoever he is, because it's the middle of the US that probably emerges one of the most competitive locations on the planet in terms of cost and quality control. But the Chinese are so certain that they cannot regain their footing in low cost manufacturing. This is the fundamental reason they're pursuing the Belt and Road Initiative, which is not just about connectivity physically between China and the rest of the world. It's about generating GDP outside the country because they can't generate enough inside the country. And it's about creating a digital network that will work in China's favor. Now, the key point here is the Chinese have just introduced something called the social credit system. And if you haven't looked at this, you need to look at it. The social credit system is basically about creating an Uber score for every individual based on their level of social compliance. So if you jaywalk, not only does your social credit score go down, but you'll get a text message in your phone, in your pocket, before you're even halfway through the street that you're jaywalking, that has the fine, and your name and part of your government number are going to go up on the nearest OLED screen at the nearest intersection. If you leave your bicycle in the footpath, if you watch pornography, if you have debt, in other words, all the different behaviors that the government deems inappropriate contribute to your social credit score. Now, my problem with this is I'm with Frank Zappa, who said progress comes from deviation from the norm. Now, I think that's true. And I don't think you can say to people, I want you to behave in an ever narrower way, except when you go to work, and I want you to be super innovative there. I just don't see how that works. And I think this works hugely to the advantage of the West. And I think that is partly why China is investing so much money in its interface with other parts of the emerging markets that are more competitive. So that's point one. China, I'm not so sure, is so obviously the future. Second, I will say Mexico has emerged as the new China. Everybody goes, what? I haven't heard that before. Yeah, well, look at the level of Chinese investment in Mexico, partly because its wages are 20 to 40% cheaper than China, but its quality control is American standard. And they're so deeply integrated into the supply chain in the United States. And you say, yeah, but Trump is building a wall. Well, here we come smack into another unbelievable bias. For the last 5 years, well, 4 years, certainly, the markets have been very biased against the United States. And certainly since Trump was elected, they went, oh, I don't like Trump. Therefore, I don't want to invest in the United States. Turns out the U.S. has been the best performing industrialized economy in the world. And Mexico has been the best performing emerging market. And the two, of course, are juxtaposed. So while everybody's thinking, but the wall is going up, when I talk to business people, both in Mexico and in the U.S. and in China, they all say, I don't really care. He can build a wall, but we're going to use a nifty piece of technology called an airplane or a train to go right over it. Like, it doesn't make any difference to the commercial side of transactions. So suddenly, the focus in emerging market investing is not China, it's Mexico. And the overall focus in the industrialized world has caught people by surprise because their bias was, I don't like the president, therefore he can't have a good economy. You can hate the president and he still can produce an economy. Whether it's all his doing, we can debate, but the point is, it's happening. Let's pick another one, super hot topic, Brexit. Brexit must be a disaster for the United Kingdom. Now, these are my personal views, not the views of the government, but it's fascinating. When I talk to the big institutional investors, they all say, you know, the bottom line is I may not like the uncertainty of Brexit, but it's still very difficult to make any money in France, in Germany. The economies are not performing well. It's not so friendly to investors. The fact is the UK is leading in artificial intelligence, biomedical, highly skilled engineering, world class. I'm in the manufacturing sector. I actually manufacture commercial drones, a space that you would think the Chinese own. Turns out not so much. And I'm able to produce in the United Kingdom something that's less expensive and has vastly more capability than anything coming out of China. So this idea that Brexit must equal a disaster doesn't really add up. And now let's add to it, Brexit means sterling falls. Well, you're all smart enough to know that means everybody gets a better deal. And this is happening at a time in history when there's a lot of instability in emerging markets, more inflation, more social unrest, uncertainty of various kinds. Everybody is saying, I want a foothold in the UK because I like the rule of law. So interestingly, the people who lack the most confidence in the future are the British. The whole rest of the world, as far as I can tell, is going, we really think Britain looks great. And now it's going to do more business with the rest of the world, which, by the way, is growing faster than the European Union. And they don't lose the EU, they just change the terms. So yes, there'll be a somewhat higher tax rate on some goods, but now you'll be doing much more business with the United States, much more business with Africa, much more business with Latin America, all of which is a good thing. Another big, bold comment. There's a tech wreck going on. Therefore, tech is not investable. Well, what's happened, in my opinion, is when we had the bailout, a huge amount of money went into the tech sector, mainly because there just was a huge amount of money. And so some of it was bound to go into the riskiest possible stuff. And at that time, there were only a few firms that were large enough to actually receive that much capital. We know them, Amazon, Facebook, et cetera. So the expectation for their performance is naturally disappointed now, because frankly, they had an amazing run. So now we're having a pullback and people are beginning to ask questions about technology. So they say, oh, well, there's a tech wreck. But I'm in tech. And what I see is there's so much dry powder. Every sovereign wealth fund is loaded to the gills with cash. Every pension fund in the world is underfunded and needs to put the capital somewhere. They're all saying to me, Pippa, now we got a little inflation everywhere too, so I got to get out of cash. So what they hope and pray for is the stock market falls just a little because we'll buy everything. Now that's exactly what happened in January, right? Everybody said the stock markets are falling apart and we're all going to have a disaster. Turns out best January in a long time, maybe on record. It's because so much dry powder, because your assumption, your bias is that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, so the liquidity is going away. Wrong. If you raise interest rates 3, 4, 5 times, you put $20 trillion into the system. It's like taking a cup of water out of the Pacific Ocean. It doesn't actually tighten anything. It barely begins the normalization process. And by having the Fed and other central banks say, it's safe, it's okay, the economy is strong enough to withstand another rate hike, it like rubber stamps the fact that the world economy is okay. So what does everybody do? Buys equities. So I think this idea that tech wreck means not investable is totally wrong. And as somebody who's about to enter a Series A, I can tell you the demand for the next Facebook, the next Amazon, the next innovator is off the chart. Everybody's looking for it. And what I see are lots of people are in a position to supply it as well. Because technology has changed the landscape. You don't need to have a huge IBM lab anymore to create world-class technology. You can do it with a handful of people. And I say that as someone who's in the middle of doing that myself. I also think a lot of investors haven't understood a profound change that is occurring on the investment landscape. This is part of the general bias of, I think I understand because I've been doing this for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years or however long you've been doing it. It is irrelevant how long you've been doing it. What we're going through now is such a profound transformation driven by technology. It totally changes the rules of the game. So as an example, I think one of the core skills that is required going forward is to understand what China is doing with that Uber score that I described. This is happening universally. And what it really is the ubiquitous collection of data about each and every one of us. Every time we pass a camera at a Westfield shopping mall, every time we step in our shoes, because there's a chip in the shoe now that reveals how you walk, every time you have an Internet of Things device in your home and you shout to the kids, the spaghetti's ready, everybody in the world knows you buy spaghetti at your house. If you have an automated vacuum cleaner, it's broadcasting the dimensions of the rooms, the human use of the space, whether you're sleeping in it, whether you're speaking in it, and it's true for everything, down to the rubbish bin and the refrigerator. So all of these like quadrillions of data points are forming a kind of holographic space that is rather like a crystal ball. It is a space that allows us to take in previously independent silos of information, and what connects all those dots together is artificial intelligence. This is now totally underway. And if you don't know how to conjure forth answers from this crystal ball, you will not be able to invest in the new environment. And you won't understand it if you don't get that it's a place of radical transparency. I mean, truly radical transparency. So the internet now genuinely does know more about you than you know about yourself. For example, when I talk to the biggest banks in the world, they know when you are going to get divorced well before you know. And they can see it in the spending patterns of the two spouses. And what they do now is they start to drive down the credit overdraft limit of the lower earning partner in anticipation of the financial wreck that is coming. This is already real. This is not some sci-fi future. So it's important if you're going to be an investor to understand how that game works. Now, what I'm describing is broad psychometric profiling. One of the really interesting things about the Jeff Bezos story at Amazon, which is, you know, all about his personal life, talk about radical transparency, even he is subject to this. What is also revealed is that Amazon is doing exactly the same thing the Chinese are doing. And I would recommend that you look at a company called SenseTime. SenseTime is the most valuable startup in the world. It is a Chinese company worth $6 billion. It's about to be worth $8 billion. It does facial recognition. Now, that isn't about recognizing your particular face. It's about recognizing your emotional state, so that the data can be sold to someone who then knows how to sell to you because they understand your emotional hot buttons. Now, that is also what Amazon is doing, and Facebook, and everyone else. So now we're talking about a world where emotions become the driver of investment opportunity, to Graham's point in the previous session. I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second, but I want you to understand how profound this change is. This is why President Putin says that artificial intelligence is the new frontier of geopolitics, because whoever has greatest command over this holographic space of data points and whoever has the greatest computational power behind it, they can break everybody else's codes. And it doesn't matter whether that's your personal Bitcoin password or nuclear codes. All of it becomes susceptible in this holographic space. Now, we are about to turbocharge the crystal ball. You probably haven't noticed, but here's another thing that's passing people by. Defense spending is all-time record highs. I would argue, and have argued the last few years, that defense spending is the new quantitative easing. And where is it going? It's going on the crystal ball. It is going on all these technologies. It's not being spent on aircraft carriers. It's being spent on things like facial recognition. So there are three big pushes in the computational space you need to be aware of. One is supercomputing and quantum computing. So the Americans now own two computers made by IBM and NVIDIA. called Summit and Sierra. Just to give you an idea, we keep it at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is where we keep our nuclear capability. That's how valuable this is. And what it can do, Summit can calculate in 1 second what would take a human being 6.3 billion years, that's B for boy, to calculate. So the thing is, when you have these quadrillions of data points, you got to have the computational capacity to crunch those numbers. So the new space race is for that. And that's why the Chinese are now building this new facility in Anhui province, which should be done next year. They say when it's completed, it will have 1 million times the computational capability of the entire planet today. 1 million times the computational capacity of the entire planet today. So the scale is almost unimaginable. The Russians are also building their version. So this is the new space race. So now I've given you a whole bunch of touch points, and everybody goes, wow, I wasn't thinking about any of those. Well, this is the point of what is your belief system preventing you from seeing. Now, let me get into behaviors. I've just written a book, which is very much about the behavior of leaders, but it's equally applicable to all of you in the room and applicable to me. Because by nature of the age that we are, we've all been taught to be highly, highly analytical. And we believe deep in our hearts that the answer lies in the numbers. If I just had better data, if I just had a better spreadsheet, I could figure this out. I think it's totally wrong. And in fact, the way we've seen our leaders being completely blindsided by Trump, by Brexit, by the performance of the US economy, by the decline of the Chinese economy, by almost everything that's blindsided people in recent years, it's come from the fact that they have this deep belief that if they are just more quantitative, if they drill deeper into quantitative detail, they will find the answer. The problem is it leaves you completely blind to the qualitative. So you're drilled down, but you have no ability to look across. You go deeper into the math and completely miss the mood. You think you know the facts, but you have no sense of how people feel. And this is how we keep being blindsided by populism, by changes in behaviors that don't add up if you're being purely quantitative. So I strongly recommend that you start thinking about investment as not something that is a purely technical thing, but it involves assessing the human condition and human perception of reality. Human perception of reality is really interesting. So for example, another assumption, a bias, an inbuilt belief, automation equals unemployment. Everybody says it, right? So it must be true. I'm in the middle of that, right? I'm producing aerial robotics that replace humans for many activities. But as an economist, when I look at it, I see the first robotic was introduced in 1804. It was the Jacquard weaving loom. Remember the Luddites smashed up the weaving looms? That's what it was. Well, we've had nothing but more automation and robotics since that time. And what is the end result when I look around the world today? Record level employment in virtually every part of the world economy, from China to the United States, across Africa and elsewhere. Automation and robotics don't equal unemployment. They equal radical change. So I see, you know, the accounting firms come out with statements like 10% of the workforce will have to change because of automation and robotics, or 40%. I think it's all nonsense. It's 100%, including every single one of you and me. We will absolutely have to change and radically change what we do, how we do it, how we invest, how we go through our day, because automation robotics will profoundly change our ability to do stuff. So that's another sort of inbuilt bias belief that I think is worth thinking about. I'll finish with the last couple of things. Another one is the idea, which has been around a long time, that I would call armchair investing. This is the belief that you can sit comfortably in your home or at your office and invest from a chair, that you can study the world, and because the internet's right there in front of you, you can know what's going on out there. I've been in financial markets since the early 1990s, started working in politics in the mid-1980s, and my life experience tells me it's just wrong. You actually have to get out there and see what's going on, talk to people, and get involved with things. I'll come back to the area that I'm in, which is drones. Drones is fascinating because people think they understand drones, right? Because they see them at the toy shop and they've tried them once or twice maybe, and they go, well, they're toys and they break. So they have no conception of what a robotic tool that happens to fly can do. And as a result, they'll make judgments about the drone industry based on erroneous understanding of what the technology is actually capable of. In my particular space, people will say, I like drones the way you might say I like cars. And what you mean by that are go-karts, Fords, Fiats, Ferraris, and 14-wheeler trucks. They're all drones. The market has hardly begun to differentiate in this area. So we have this weird situation where, you know, Vale is on the brink of potential bankruptcy because of a dam break in Brazil that happened a few weeks ago that could have easily been solved with a piece of equipment that wouldn't even have made a statistical aberration on their balance sheet. Now, how is that possible? That is possible because people already assume they know, and they haven't gone and tried what is technology capable of delivering. So my strong recommendation is, if whatever you think you know about China, if you haven't been there in a while, you've got to go. Whatever you think you know about Mexico, if you haven't been, you got to go. If whatever you think you know about a particular innovation and technology, by the way, virtual reality is another one. Everybody's like, oh, that's just for kids. Then you don't know. You have to go try stuff. I'll finish with just a couple of things that are probably equally or more challenging than what I've already said, but we're on such limited time and I want to get you guys going on your thought process. One thing is clear to me, people genuinely believe they understand the system. They understand the system of money. They understand the system of accounting. Half of you probably have, I don't know, CFAs or Series A's or the equivalent of them. You've devoted a lot of time and energy to understanding the rules of the game. So if I say to you, but it's possible that we can rip up the entire system of money and accounting and start again, that comes as a big shock. Well, that is exactly what I'm going to argue to you. That when you have a debt problem that's so big that you can't pay it off, that extracting the taxes from the citizens would actually cause social unrest if you tried to make the numbers balance out. And this is a global phenomenon. So bottom line, there is one way you can deal with the problem. You can destroy the system of money and accounting and start again. Now, the last time this happened really visibly was in 1834. And at that time, the British had a system of money and accounting called tally sticks. And they used these wooden sticks that they broke in half very roughly so the two sides would match. And the larger end of the stick went to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and it had a record of all your tax payments and ownership of assets. The shorter end of the stick, which was referred to as the stock end of the stick, which is where we get the term stock market, that you kept, and that was your personal record. Now, the problem was you can't inflate very easily with a tally stick system. And at the time, in the early 1830s, you know, the French are still at the barricades. It's a populist period of history, massive debt, and government can't quite figure out what to do. So they go, we have a new technology. It's called paper money. And if we shift to paper money, it's much easier to inflate with paper money than with wooden sticks. And you know what the public said? Are you out of your mind? Do you think I'm going to hand over this board that has my personal record, my name, for a piece of paper that doesn't have my name on it? Forget about it. Never going to do it. So the British government said, fine, we will confiscate the tally sticks, take them to London, and burn them in Parliament so that you can't use them in future. And I've put up on Twitter under @DrPippaM, but I quoted Portfolio Construction as well, the image of Parliament burning to the ground as they misjudged the amount of heat that would be thrown off by the destruction of the system of money and accounting. And it was painted by J.M.W. Turner. It's a rather beautiful painting, but a stark reminder that government absolutely can take away the whole system of money and accounting. And I would argue that we're absolutely undergoing that transformation right now. And you already know the name of the new system of money. It's called electronic money. E-money behaves very differently from paper money because now it's digital. So your capacity to inflate with that is unlimited in a way that paper money couldn't accommodate. And the other piece of it is what you might call blockchain, but I personally have doubts about the specificity of blockchain technology. But I will say this, a timestamp is the key point. That's really what blockchain is about. And when you add together electronic money with ubiquitous collection of data about you personally with a timestamp, we now know, did you buy that shirt when you were in your living room? At what time of day, or were you in Paris? In which case, the tax rate is going to be the French tax rate because they could see that that's where you were. It completely transforms how the finance and money system works. And I think if you haven't thought about this, you need to, because it is a profound change, except this time, it won't be so visible as Parliament burning down because it'll happen invisibly. And by the way, the amount of cash being used in most industrialized economies is already down to less than 3%. So we're already there pretty much. But the consequences of an entirely digital money and accounting system with tracking of every individual, this is a new operating environment. And I think that you need to think about that. I'll give one more thing and then I'll finish because, Graham, I know you want to do a little bit of back and forth with me. One last kind of bias belief that would be nice to break before I finish. And that is the belief that President Trump will definitely run again. And I would like to propose, I think there's a very high probability that he is not going to run again. And interestingly, people who hate him, when I say, I think he's not going to run again, then they often will say, well, then the markets are going to fall apart. And I'm like, I thought you didn't like him. Well, I don't, but he's been so friendly to markets. If he goes, then the markets are going to fall apart. Okay, let's parse this apart. But what I do think is, it's a bit of a long story, too much detail to go into, but the legal investigations into Trump, forget the Mueller case. It's virtually irrelevant. He can pardon everyone, right? And he can sign an executive order that says the president can pardon himself. Yes, the courts will challenge it, but it'll take years. But he has no power to pardon in the state and local investigations, New York State, Manhattan prosecutor. And in those cases, the only real way to fight it is to throw a lot of money at it. Now recall, the reason he ran in the first place was because he wanted to launch what they're calling TNN, that's the Trump News Network, which would challenge CNN. Now, in the end, he won, which was not what he expected. What he thought he was doing was creating a media story to raise money for that. Well, notice lately, he keeps saying, CNN needs a challenger. There's no other opposing voice that gets this right. Yeah, that's because that's what he wants to launch. And to be honest, I think he's correct in the assessment that the Oval Office is a smaller platform than what TNN would be. And so I think there's a chance that he jumps out of politics and into a much more influential position that also generates a huge amount of cash. And the one thing the political establishment in the United States is not ready for is his absence. It's very interesting, right? Democrats are all looking to push anti-Trump. And then what if he's not there? It's very interesting. And I would keep an eye on this because it's going to cause volatility and it's going to make markets have to think, well, okay, if he goes, who gets in? And is that good or is that bad for the economy that's been the best performing industrialized market in the world? So there's a whole bunch of things about behaviors and beliefs and biases. I think all of them, you could spend days on every single one of these. But the main thing is to shake yourself a little and really think about what are my assumptions and are they just built on a habit or do they really have roots in reality? Because reality today is so different from anything I've seen during my entire career in finance. I think personally, it's a fascinating moment. And let me, the last thing I'll say is very exciting because, by the way, when the British destroyed the system of money and accounting,
and introduced a new one, what happened next? The Industrial Revolution. And I think we're in a new Industrial Revolution. The amount of innovation happening out there is shocking to me. Little companies like my own, who will be able to take advantage of new technology being introduced that actually supports the growth of the world economy. So where most people are mentally preparing for a meltdown, I hope I've just made the case that you ought to think equally hard about the possibility of a melt up.